This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580. We're also online at WILL.UIUC.EDU. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for joining us this afternoon. Trying to be savvy consumers, we look at the labels on the foods we bring home from the supermarket. We may scan the list of ingredients only to find ourselves stumped, though. What the heck is polysorbate 60? On the program today, a look at what goes into our processed foods. Our guest is Steve Ettlinger. He is the author of Twinkie Deconstructed, My Journey to Discover How the Ingredients Found in Processed Foods Are Grown, Mined, Yes, Mined, and Manipulated into What America Eats. Stories about the ingredients that go into our food products have been in the headlines recently as we've learned that there are holes in our food safety net. One of the stories receiving a good deal of attention has been contaminated whey from China that turned up in pet food. It's raised questions about the safety of imported ingredients that go into processed foods for humans. Ettlinger's book, Twinkie Deconstructed, is an excellent introduction to the mysteries of processed foods. It is enlightening, entertaining, and sobering. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for our guest. You can join us with your questions and comments. The phone number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number is 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Steve Ettlinger is the author of six books, including books on beer and hardware. His new book, Twinkie Deconstructed, is published by Hudson Street Press. And there's a website for the book. It is www.twinkiedeconstructed.com. 333-9455, 800-222-9455. And before I say hello directly to Steve, I'm going to pass on this weather information. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a severe thunderstorm warning for northeastern Christian County in central Illinois and Macon County in central Illinois until 1:45 this afternoon. At 1:06, National Weather Service Doppler radar indicated a severe thunderstorm capable of producing penny-sized hail. The storm was located 3 miles south of Blue Mound, or about 12 miles northeast of Taylorville, and was moving northeast at 30 miles per hour. Stay tuned to AM 580 for the latest on the weather. And now, good afternoon to Steve Ettlinger. Good afternoon. How are you?
I'm just fine, thanks. How are you?
Well, I'm fine, thanks. Well, that question, what is polysorbate 60? That's the question that got you started on this project. Tell us the story.
Well, you know, like many parents, I took my kids to the beach, fed them some ice cream bars, and we're sitting down at the picnic table. I'm idly reading the ingredient label, which is a yard long. The kids are eating and wondering why Daddy's always reading the labels. And they said, well, you know, what you reading, Dad? What's in the ice cream bars? And I started reading a few things, and they started reading. My daughter, age 6, says, Daddy, where does polysorbate 60 come from? And, of course, I hadn't a clue. And being a popular reference writer, I had to just, I said, you know, well, I've got to find that answer. It had been dogging me for years, and I've always been intrigued.
Yeah.
That was the motivation to actually do it.
And a big hats off to your kids.
Well, they're pretty inquisitive kids, so that's nice.
Yeah, yeah. So you set out to find a product that, in your words, would serve as a prism through which to address the subject, to find the answer to what is polysorbate 60. So why did you decide on Twinkies?
Well, I did check out a number of common products, including a large quantity of breads. You know, a lot of bread labels have lots of ingredients, which is sort of surprising when you think of bread being mostly flour and water, maybe yeast. And that just wasn't interesting enough, and they didn't have a variety of ingredients. I wanted something that had a variety, had preservatives and colors and flavors and emulsifiers and all kinds of things like that, and that was also well-known. When I tripped over the Twinkie in the supermarket, I realized I just had it there, on top of which the Twinkie's such an icon of snack food.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Would you tell us a little bit about the cake's history?
You know, it was invented near you. It was invented near Chicago, Schiller Park, in 1930 by a guy named Jimmy Dewar, who was a and a vice president, an employee of a bakery that was has since been absorbed by Hostess called Continental Bakeries. He was trying to find a use for the empty baking pans that were used in the summer for strawberry shortcake. And he came up with the idea of a little little vanilla cake filled with, at that time, banana cream. He really had a winner. While he was driving to the office to present his idea to his bosses, he passed a billboard for Twinkle Toe Shoes and decided that the name of the cake had to be Twinkies. I think the guy was a genius.
Yeah, yeah. Well, here it is today. I have some right here.
Oh, good. Are we going to have a Twinkie tasting on the air?
I don't think so. I think I'll save that for a treat later.
Well, because kids are listening.
Yeah. Right. Yeah, there you go.
But, you know, I did have a Twinkie tasting over the phone one morning very early that sticks in my mind. It was quite amazing. I was consulting with a number of flavorists or professional flavor creators to identify the flavors used in Twinkies because they're only listed as natural and artificial. Mm-hmm. The actual flavors are not listed. And this woman who was quite accomplished in her field. She was recently began consulting on her own, but she'd been working for major food companies that I don't want to name, but they're the household names. And she said, you know, gosh, I haven't had one for years. I really ought to taste one before I talk to you. So that we decided to talk the next morning, and she said she'd bought the Twinkies but hadn't tried one yet. So I said, well, I think I'll try it now. So I hear the crinkling of the plastic being unwrapped, and mm-hmm. I'm ready for her to sort of nibble and maybe make some pronouncement about aldehydes or ketones or something. And instead she says, that's great. And I really had to laugh. We did, she and others agreed, though, that only vanilla and butter are the flavors. Any other flavors you might taste are the result of cooking.
And it's got all that great mouthfeel. That's how, one of the terms that they use in the business.
Mouthfeel, yes. Yeah. I don't care for the mouthfeel. Yeah. I have made or tasted others that have made what I call gourmet versions, and I thought they were much better. I think they're too oily, but it's a matter of taste.
Yeah.
And the mouthfeel is what the kids like, I think, the smoothness of the filling and in particular. But it's got an aftertaste that's pretty strong, which regular whipped cream does not have.
Yeah. I haven't had one in a very long time, and Harriet, my producer, and I, we're going to split this package later this afternoon, and we'll compare notes.
I hope so.
But I wouldn't want to go there on the air and, you know, have somebody need to tap me on the back, you know, do a Heimlich maneuver here. It's very dangerous to eat.
It would boost your ratings.
Yeah, eat food on the air. How does one get to be a flavorist? This is very interesting. All the different kinds of jobs that there are in this business.
Right. I came across very dedicated, accomplished, nice professionals in fields that I hadn't been familiar with at all before. It was very illuminating. Food science in general, food formulators are what I guess you would call chefs in the commercial world. In other words, if you decided to start a restaurant, which would be the equivalent of a food company, and you want to have a cracker in your food company, or you want to have, I don't know, a lobster dish in your restaurant, you'd ask your chef, you'd say, you know, could you make something that's lighter or heavier than this, so it tastes like that, you know, dry, moist, what have you, and the price point would be this or that or the other. Those people are food formulators. They work with the ingredients, such as found in the Twinkies, because those are found in all processed foods, to make something that works for your price point and for your flavor, of course, whatever it is you want for the product. But also, they work to make sure it can be manufactured in the factory. For example, when I asked people why the recipe changed over time, because I found even over the 5 years or so I worked on this that some ingredients were dropped or added, they said, well, sometimes it's a function of price. Sometimes there's, a new development, you know, a new kind of shortening or what have you. But it also might be because they have new machines or old machines that mix the batter or pump it through the tubes that go into the molds or what have you. So these people are working all the time to solve problems that the home cook doesn't have. One of my favorite problems that I liked was that one ingredient might help possibly hold the bubbles in the batter
mm-hmm.
when it's at the bottom of a kettle that holds 4,000 or 5,000 gallons. When you think about it, there's a lot of pressure down at the bottom, and if you don't have something firming up the bubbles, it would be sort of condensed. At home, that doesn't happen. You whip it up, the bubbles are there, you pour it into the mold, and you cook it.
Well, at home, you know, we can bake a cake with a fraction of the ingredients in a Twinkie. We use butter, sugar, eggs, flour, baking powder, salt.
Right.
And then you've got one cake, you know, maybe two pans, one oven, one family.
Right.
And it's going to last 1 to 2 days.
Oh, well, if you make it really good, it'll last 5 minutes.
Right.
Actually, that's very intriguing. I asked, why don't we use preservatives? You know, I asked rhetorically, why don't we use preservatives in the home cake? And the answer is because people eat it quickly. I, in fact, made a Twinkie equivalent with home ingredients, wrapped it in plastic, put it on a shelf, and about a week later it was green.
Yeah.
So they do need preservatives. Now, the sugar, a cake is almost half sugar, and the sugar helps to preserve it quite a bit. And even Twinkies dry out. They rely on the packaging to keep moist on the shelf. But they do need a little sorbic acid. It's the only preservative in Twinkies, sorbic acid.
Yeah.
And that keeps the mold down. And ironically, sorbic acid is a food. It's a fatty acid, almost like olive oil. So, which I found strange because guess what it's made from? Natural gas.
Well, that's wild.
Yes.
Is it all about shelf life?
Yeah, shelf life is the holy grail. The taste and all, you know, all these products are sort of similar. But with shelf life, you can make that much more money. You can ship that many more and reduce your costs. You certainly don't have to take things back because if it's a long shelf life, if you figure things out right, you know, they'll sell before they get worn out on the shelf. When Twinkies first came out, they didn't have all these artificial ingredients. And they spoiled after 3 or 4 days, which was good for no one.
How many ingredients are in a Twinkie?
I counted 39, and I didn't have to go far in my research. I looked at the label. In fact, the Twinkie ingredient list is the table of contents for Twinkie Deconstructed.
Right. Yeah.
39. Now, in that 39, if you wanted to make your home cake, you couldn't make it just with 6 ingredients because the white flour that you buy, all-purpose flour or cake flour, in the United States, white flour is bleached and enriched. And I counted those ingredients because you don't have to have them. And those are the vitamins and minerals and so forth, which are made from, well, let's just say they're not made from fruit and vegetables.
Yeah. Well, that's the first ingredient listed, enriched bleached flour, and in parentheses on the label here, then the ingredients in the enriched bleached flour are listed. And wheat flour is the place where our tour of processed foods and Twinkie Deconstructed begins. And this was very interesting to realize. There are 6 kinds of wheat. That's more or less where you begin. Is there a particular type that's used most often in processed baked goods?
Cake usually use soft red winter wheat. And the other types are used for things like pasta, what's a harder durum wheat. Bread baking wants a different kind of wheat. There's some regional preferences, of course, which is why if you read the serious baking books, cookbooks, you'll find that they indicate that the recipe has to be changed if it's in, say, Louisiana or Mississippi versus, say, Massachusetts, because the flour that you're likely to find there is made from a different kind of wheat. They vary quite a bit, as I said, for pasta, bread, and, you know, high-protein pizza dough, for example, which is very stretchy and tough and chewy, is the opposite of what you want for cake, which is light, fluffy, and weak.
Now, why bleach the flour?
There are 2 reasons. I guess there are 3. The third one being because it's been bleached forever and ever. But the modern consumer who took root, I think, in the 1800s, has always been a sucker for something that's light and white. You know, the white color of the flour is supposed to make it look purer than the whole wheat flour. It's normally yellow, but if it sits around for a while, like 6 or 8 weeks, it'll turn white. It'll naturally oxidize. So the originally people bleached flour to speed up that oxidation process to make it whiter without having to wait. Time is money. However, that also helps control the protein and makes it, especially for cake flour, makes it a weaker protein, so it's the softer flour, which is what you want for cake. So it acidifies it slightly. It's bleached with chlorine, which, although toxic, extremely toxic, very dangerous gas, is used in minute doses. It immediately turns into, among other things, hydrochloric acid. So it slightly acidifies the flour, which is what the baking experts tell you that you want. It's certainly nothing to worry about, although it's kind of amazing that we put use this toxic gas.
Yeah, yeah. And a moment ago you mentioned gas, and one of the places that you went to for the research for this book was you went down into a mine to learn about baking soda.
Yeah. You know, again, your home recipe includes baking powder, baking soda. Baking powder is made with baking soda and two other things, acids, monocalcium phosphate and sodium acid pyrophosphate. Those are on the ingredient label of that little can you have it in your home kitchen. Almost every brand has the same stuff, and actually most of them are made by the same company. In any case, the sodium bicarbonate is made from sodium carbonate that is mined almost exclusively for U.S. manufacturers in Green River, Wyoming. There are five companies mining there, including Arm & Hammer. And they've been mining there since about 1950. And the rest of the world is made chemically through a pretty nasty process, in fact. Anyway, I got invited to go take a look. I find myself going down 1,600 feet, which is as far down as the world's tallest building is tall. I get into a Jeep and drive half an hour to get to the active face. That's how big this mine is, and it's one of five. It was stupendous. At the active face, which is 750 feet long, there's a giant claw digging away at the wall, 3 feet at a time. I kind of freaked out. Here I am with my emergency breathing apparatus, my hard hat. My knees are shaking. I'm saying, well, all this for a little cake or a little yellow box that sits in my refrigerator? It was kind of amazing. The mine face has a conveyor. The rocks are taken up to the surface and then crushed and processed ever so slightly into a slurry, which is turned into a liquid, which is almost pure sodium carbonate, and then they add some carbon dioxide to it, bubble it up through the mix to turn it into sodium bicarbonate. And I tasted some fresh. It was delicious.
Seriously?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. Is it, it's very much different from the taste of the baking soda that we have on the shelf?
No, it was more the texture. It was because it was warm.
Yeah.
And it was lighter. It was like, you know, like freshly sifted flour. But as far as taste sensations go, I'll stick to wine and chocolate.
Good. By the way, a friend of mine noted that she had given her husband not too long ago a book that pairs wines with foods, and actually in the book there's a pairing for Twinkies.
No.
Yes.
Oh, I've got to see that book.
Okay, I hope if she's listening she'll bring us the name of the book. But anyway, the suggestion is Asti Spumanti.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I don't know what you think.
Well, first of all, Asti Spumanti is not a champagne, it's sparkling wine, but it's sweet. And generally you want a sweet one to go with your sweet desserts. I'd say that's a great one. Now, I'll one-up you with a funny story.
Okay.
In March, my book was published last month, and we had I threw a big launch party because I worked on it so long, and I was in dire need of a party. We got a little carried away. I thought we'd have Twinkies and champagne. Why not? Live it up. So I also, at first, I was just going to be Twinkies and champagne, and then when I got carried away, we got a fabulous gourmet chef from a famous restaurant, Gramercy Tavern, to make gourmet Twinkies. And then we had a Twinkie tasting. We got about three or four different brands of commercial knockoffs of Twinkies. And I don't know if you know this, but there are like four or five brands nationally that make the same cake, that look the same, you know, it's competitive.
Yeah.
Little Debbie's, Mrs. Freshley's, Lady Linda Twinkies. And then another chef made a vegan, organic, whole wheat Twinkie, which was, I have to say, excellent. So we had a Twinkie tasting, and we got some media coverage. But I wanted to buy champagne as cheaply as possible, so I called my good friend Ed McCarthy, with whom I'd worked on Wine for Dummies. He's a champagne expert. In fact, we did a book called Champagne for Dummies. I said, I didn't call it to, you know, I wouldn't dare ask him what he recommends. I just asked him, where can I get cheap champagne? Where, you know, where do you buy when you need a lot of it for a reception? Or, you know, I'm a consumer. And, you know, hoping maybe he'd say, maybe there's PR, some PR company could give me a case. But he said that, by the way, the champagne companies never give it away because everyone's asking him all the time. And he suggested a liquor store where, he said, you know, this is, you'll probably pay about $24. And, you know, he was just, go ahead, if you want to, give me a call if you want to know which one to choose. And I said, okay, thinking he'd tell me what was simply a better champagne. Well, when I called him, because there were four or five brands in the same price range, he started saying, oh, no, that one's a little too dry. No, with a Twinkie, you want one that's a little sweeter. you know, no, that's picked too early in the spring. Or, you know, and he started getting really technical about it, and I was cracking up. I don't think he realized how much he'd gotten into it. It was really funny.
Yeah. Is there a recipe for gourmet Twinkies at TwinkieDeconstructed.com?
No, I should probably put one there. But yeah. The Gramercy Tavern chef, she just made a yellow cake with a cream filling of some sort and with as few ingredients as possible. And I found that just with a yellow cake mix and whipped cream, I bought organic heavy cream, whipping cream, and mix it with air, of course, and with confectioner's sugar, and it was dynamite. It had the texture of the cream filling in the real Twinkie, but it had the taste, of course, of real whipped cream, which is delicious with a lot of sugar in it. And I noticed that my teeth felt clean, almost squeaky clean after eating it. Mm. And none of this cloying aftertaste that you get from the fake stuff.
Okay. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Steve Ettlinger. He is the author most recently of Twinkie Deconstructed, My Journey to Discover How the Ingredients Found in Processed Foods Are Grown, Mined, Yes, Mined, and Manipulated into What America Eats. Listeners, you can join us here this afternoon on the Afternoon Magazine with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener now in Sycamore, Illinois, on line four. Hi.
Hi. I was very interested to hear your guest talking about flours, and I have given up using cake flour because it's chlorinated. And I've heard that the European Union and the United Kingdom consider the safety of this stuff unproven and forbid its use. And I just wondered if you could help me out as for a substitute, because I haven't found anything that works as well as cake flour.
Oh, my. Well, first of all, I have to apologize, because while I researched a lot about baking, my interest was in the ingredients, not so much the alternatives. But I did find, I believe it's King Arthur flour in Vermont, which is, I believe, nationally distributed, has, I believe they tried to, they have some alternative cake flour, but I couldn't tell you. My vegan chef, I'm not sure what she used, is Fran Costigan, and I believe she has a website that's FranCostigan.com. where she might be able to help you. I'll try it right now to see if this is... Yeah, it's FranCostigan.com. Fran, FranCostigan.com. And she has some books out, too. She may have some alternatives. Not that the... not because it's a vegan thing, but she just happens to know also organic and so forth. The problem with the bleaching, as I said, is you need it to destroy the protein as much as possible, or to temper it. You don't really destroy it, and the bleaching helps in that case. Now, there is another way to research this, which is I'm not familiar with the programs at the University of Illinois, but there probably is a food science program, and they may know of some alternative. What I appreciate from your call is bringing this up. I'd never heard about that being banned, chlorine bleach being banned by the EU, and I'm going to check that out. That is fascinating.
Well, I can tell you that I found out about it through Mr. Harold McGee's book on food and cooking.
Oh, yeah.
And I figured you'd probably be familiar with that.
I am. It's a big book, though. I missed that part.
I use it religiously for trying to tweak baking recipes that I use.
Good for you.
And I just found that to be rather disturbing, so I quit using cake flour, although I was getting very good results with it. But needless to say, now I've taken a step backwards. I'm trying to recoup my losses, so to speak.
Right.
This is the newest version. He just came out with it a couple of years ago. There was an older version about 20 years ago that may not have had that in it.
I have both, and I will. When I get off the air, I'm going to check that out. That's really fascinating.
Well, then look at page 556.
Oh,
since I have the book right in front.
It is a big book.
556?
Yeah, 556.
Okay, well, see, we traded data here. You got Fran Costigan, and I got Harold McGee.
And would you spell Fran's last name again?
Costigan.
Got it. All right. Well, thank you very much.
Well, thank you.
You're very welcome. Other calls are invited. We encourage you to join us this afternoon. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Also, our flour is enriched. Talk with us a little bit about that. Why the reason? What's the reason for that, and how is it enriched?
Okay. It's enriched because it's not whole wheat flour. At the same time, millers decided to make a white flour because it would appeal to the consumer, something new and different. They were removing a lot of the vitamins that make flour nutritious. Whole wheat is not enriched. It's naturally nutritious. And that became a problem. However, the main reason we started putting vitamins back into the flour was because the government wanted to fight beginning of the last century, the early 1900s, pellagra and other diseases that we were having, especially in the South, the rural areas, to the extent that in 1919, I think it was, 10,000 people died of pellagra, and now almost no one does. Beriberi is not a problem anymore. Anemia is less of a problem in general because the government decided to try to find a food that everybody ate into which they could ask the manufacturers to put vitamins and minerals that were required. This started in 1940 and oh my, excuse me, my power just went out in my building.
Oh my.
and it's flashing on and off, so that's very strange. Well, welcome to New York. Anyway, they started it. It's a very effective and relatively inexpensive government health program. It's kind of neat. They found that really did it. And, you know, the proof is in the pudding. In Mexico, there are a lot of problems that stem from the corn-based diet, which is what, in fact, people in the first part of the 20th century in the South were eating. It's largely a corn-based diet. So they added vitamins that people really needed. And there you go. In 1968, they added another one, which was just simply a good thing, folic acid or folate, which fights birth defects.
Mm-hmm. Now, the minerals and vitamins that get into our processed foods, into our flour, come from all over the world. And as I alluded to in my introduction, concerns have been raised now recently about imported food ingredients. And I know this is something that you write about at the close of the book. You would like the system to be a little bit more less opaque. What are your thoughts on the subject?
One of the more startling things was that came from researching this book is that the companies that make many of the ingredients, most of them, are huge conglomerates, among the biggest in the world. ConAgra, I believe it is perhaps the biggest privately owned company in the world. I may have that statistic wrong. I'll have to check that out. But they're huge. ADM is near you. That's one of the biggest in the world.
Bunge.
Bunge. You have also the vitamin companies are multi-billion-dollar companies. They're established in Europe as well as in the States, and notably in Japan and China and soon Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, wherever the labor and environmental laws are favorable to high-tech business. What is annoying about that is you can't get the information you want sometimes because they are so big. You should think it would be simple. But in fact, I even called and wrote people whose names and numbers were on press releases under the title, "For more information, please contact," and still got no answer. I mean, it's not that they refused. I got no answer. I got nowhere, nothing. These are people making food, and you'd think they would be much more available because it's food. It's a little different. I didn't mind that they didn't give me tours. You know, that I understand. If a company doesn't want to give me a tour, set up to spend time with me, that's their business. They're either busy or they're very competitive and they just don't want to be bothered, or, you know, in some cases they've just had a bad track record with the press, so they just sort of clam up. That part I understand. I got plenty of information from people who worked for smaller companies or were more friendly companies or companies that were more sure of themselves, and, you know, I got in where I needed to get in, and people were very gracious. But it startled me that I could not find much of the information about vitamins in particular because they are so opaque. They don't know who makes them. You call a company in the States that's listed as a vitamin manufacturer, and they'll say, we make vitamin X or Y or Z. I say, well, great, can you direct me to whoever is in charge of the manufacturing? I'd like to interview them. And they'd say, well, try this division that we bought last year. You know, and I'd call that division, and they'd say, well, we were just sold, so we don't know who's in charge. Or, well, we just get it from a middleman in Belgium. Oh, and then the Belgian people say, well, we just get it from someplace, some middleman who imports it from Africa or China. We don't really know. And it turns out there were middlemen all along the line so that no one really knew what was going on. I did trace some of the manufacturing back to China, and I even found the companies who had websites and brochures that provided a lot of information. I hired a Chinese researcher to help me to get some of the information, and we did. But these are companies you cannot call up or write to and simply ask for information. They will not or cannot respond.
Yeah. Boy, that is, as I mentioned in my introduction, your book is enlightening and entertaining, but it is also sobering.
Right.
Yeah. And speaking of China, and another ingredient in the Twinkie is whey. And this has become a concern as the pet food situation has developed, as we've learned that there has been contaminated whey from China that wound up in pet food. And then yesterday, I believe it was, I heard a news story that the contaminated pet food that was pulled from the market has in some cases gone to feed our livestock.
Wow. That's amazing.
So it gives one pause, doesn't it?
It does. My book is not a diatribe or a polemic. In
right.
fact, I don't even take a position on that because, I wanted to concentrate on where does the stuff come from? How is it made? But it does kind of freak you out, and it may make you want to eat more whole foods from local growers. The point of processed food is sort of the opposite thrust, non-local food, food that has no relationship to a particular place. And Twinkies are a perfect example. It's totally, totally common. Twinkies aren't, I didn't single them out for any reason other than that they're well-known. All processed foods use ingredients that come from all over to the extent that you just, you know, when you buy a can of Campbell's soup, you don't taste the soup of a particular area. You don't taste the fact that their tomatoes come from Africa, which they do, or from Nebraska or California. You wouldn't know it, and they don't ever make any bones about it.
Hmm. And a listener has since called in from in between when we were talking with our first caller this afternoon, and the listener said that King Arthur Company has unbleached pastry flour, and another caller has said that, I guess we've had two calls here on this issue, that King Arthur, this caller says you can get not unbleached or not brominated, and I don't even know what that refers to.
Oh, brominated is, it's very funny. It's another chemical, a bromate, which is used to bleach flour. And King Arthur makes a big deal about it. It says, never bleached, never brominated, as if that means that it's more natural. But in fact, it's simply a choice. It's a marketing thing. You can get unbleached flour or you can get bleached flour. But to say it's never bleached and never brominated is sort of like pointing out that, I don't know, your corn only comes from Illinois. Well, that's nice, but you know it's not. It's sort of hard to get excited about. You know, corn's a commodity.
Hmm. Let's take another call. A listener in Urbana, line one. Hi.
Hi. I was curious about the pet food thing with the wheat gluten, which basically, at least at the beginning, came from Canada. And it made me wonder whether, when we talk about our trade deficit with China, would this register at all, or is this product, all these products, totally attributed to Canada, when in fact virtually all their ingredients could be, say, from China?
Well, I really can't speak at all about the pet food issue, but what I can say is that in most large-scale processed foods, like you find in your supermarket, the ingredients are commodities. They come from middlemen who in turn might mix things from all over. There'd be no way to trace much of what you get. For example, some of the fat things, the sodium stearoylactylate, are made with palm oil that comes from Malaysia and Indonesia. But it could also be made from any fat that they want to process. Could be olive oil, from another country. Could be soybean oil from our country. So, and you don't know. Once it's broken down into its basic chemicals and mixed up again in big factories and shipped across the country and mixed by two or three different companies before it turns into the final product, it's absolutely not traceable.
Hmm. I might have misspoken, and I'm right off the top of my head now. I don't know if I said wheat gluten or whey.
You said whey.
I think it's wheat gluten that was the issue in the pet food.
Okay.
I think. I'll check on that. One of the interesting things in the story is how the ingredients in these processed foods also are used for all manner of other things. Did that come as a surprise to you?
Well, yes, but I felt sort of silly because when I thought about it, it was more fun and amusing than shocking.
Yeah.
For example, salt is used, as you well know, to melt ice on highways. And you could get all bent out of shape if you didn't know that, you know, if you first learned that it's used as a chemical that reacts so violently with water, it creates heat, you know, you could say, oh, my gosh, but if you take it to the extreme, then you should get upset about water being used to mix dangerous chemicals. You know, they use water to dilute sulfuric acid and paint, and, you know, you could say that you should be shocked about everything. On the other hand, it's kind of amazing to think that the close cousin of one chemical or another that is used, say, as a jelly-like substance is also used to make antifreeze, or that some of the form of sugar is used to tan leather, or that type of thing. That just sort of throws me. A lot of the fibers that we use are in our foods are also used to make TV screens, you know, that kind of stuff. It's amusing. We shouldn't get bent out of shape about it, I think.
Okay, so yeah, not to get crazy about it.
But my favorite one, is cellulose gum, which is a derived primarily from the fuzz on cotton seeds. You know, you tend to think of cotton as a fiber, but we forget. You know, cotton seed oil is a very common food. Cotton's a vegetable, and so are trees. Trees are vegetables, and cellulose gum comes from trees as well. Anyway, it's processed much like paper with all sorts of caustic chemicals. But it turns into a food substance, and if you, it's a white powder. If you drop a little bit into some water, it turns into a gelatinous blob. It gives a nice fat feel to Twinkies cream filling, and a lot of low-calorie, low-fat salad dressings and ice creams is very, very common. But when you want to make rocket fuel be a little jelly-like, you add cellulose gum to that, too. So I love the kinship. Twinkies, rocket fuel, all part of the same.
Well.
No, not quite. That's a joke.
Corn and soybeans are in Twinkies, and before we run out of time, we should talk about this as we are in corn and soybean growing territory.
Yeah, I drove through there in the process of researching my book.
Yeah, sweetening and thickening agents. And four different corn sweeteners in Twinkies, yes?
Yes. So there are an astonishing 8 products made from corn in Twinkies. And for people in the corn business down in Champaign, I'm sure that's not surprising, but in relation to every other ingredient, corn is, you know, is king. Corn, of course, is the source of all kinds of food ingredients one way or another in our diet. But here, I found it was interesting that there were so many different types of sweeteners and thickeners. Why they need them is a very nuanced thing. They might add a minuscule portion of, say, corn flour, corn dextrins, corn starch, just a tiny, tiny bit here or there in the next place. You know, we tend to think of our ingredients as giving a, you know, making major contributions, even if it's a pinch of salt, to our cake. You know, you put in some eggs, you put in a lot of sugar, a lot of flour, you can see it. But here they're putting in, other than the corn syrups, they're putting in tiny, tiny bits.
Mm. Interesting. Let's talk with another caller. Bourbonnet, line one. Hi.
Hi. For years, I have cynically thought that the term natural flavors is too good to be true. Is it actually as wholesome and natural as it sounds, or is that some sort of legal euphemism for chips of plastic or something?
Oh, well, it better not be chips of plastic. No, it does mean they're derived from plants or fruits or flowers. They have to be if they're considered natural, but they are highly processed. You could argue that corn syrup is natural, but it is highly processed too. The natural flavoring is the process is different for each flavor, but it's basically a concentration into a point where it becomes a dry powder. But nothing else is added. That's true. It is natural. And when they make the artificial flavors or colors, then they're really going from, you know, usually starting out with petroleum generally.
Okay.
Which could be argued is natural, but
well, yeah, it comes from the ground.
But it's created, but the chemicals are created and mixed by humans. It's totally unnatural in that respect.
It reminds me of Betty White writing about being in an airport and seeing children eating foods made entirely of poisons.
Well, I'm not going to go on the record as saying these things are poison, but they are. It's very hard to wrap your mind around the fact that everything we eat is chemicals.
Right.
And these scientists are able to mix the chemicals and match the chemicals in ways that are completely amazing to people like me. They end up with, you know, creating something you can eat out of something you can't eat. It's really amazing. Now, as a chemist, a chemist would say, well, that's not amazing to me because, for example, on your kitchen table you have two dangerous chemicals, sodium, a highly reactive metal, and chlorine, which is poisonous and so reactive that it's, you know, they're both so reactive they're not found on their own in nature, and yet together they make salt. So there you go.
Yeah. We have to wrap up here, Steve. One last question. Has reporting and writing this book changed your family's buying and eating habits?
I think it's influenced me to be a little bit more vigilant about getting the fruit for dessert and the natural yogurt, not, you know, stuff that doesn't have so much sugar in it, and the whole and local foods, despite the increased cost, it's a great pleasure to know that you're eating something that's whole and possibly even local. That's a pleasure. I think that we've taken more pleasure in that recently because of the book, I'm sure.
Yeah. Steve, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, my pleasure.
Steve Ettlinger has been our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. His book, Twinkie Deconstructed, is published by Hudson Street Press. And you'll find the book. The book has a website at www.twinkiedeconstructed.com.